With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to. Courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Okay, the beauty of the Yahoo Sports Hockey podcast that I have the opportunity to chat with specialists in the world of hockey. Folks that are so dialed into certain areas that they provide the sort of insight that I'm just not going to find anywhere else. For most guests, that means going really granular on one specific subject, but with my next guest, there really are no such parameters. Mike McKenna is a recently retired NHL netminder with the sort of hockey resume that has provided a lifetime's worth of stories. He's also a podcaster, he's also a coach, and of course, he's a studio analyst with the Vegas Golden Knights. Mike, what's happening? I appreciate you waking up early to join me today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, and I always appreciate a nice intro. You touched on a lot of things that have gone on in my life since retiring and trying to stay busy. And for a long time, especially during my career when I was writing for In Goal Magazine or NHL.com and staying active in media while currently playing, I was a goalie guy. And so now I've had to expand my horizons and be able to describe and analyze everything I see in front of me for the Golden Knights on air as a studio analyst, which is so much fun, but a new challenge, which has been great. I've really enjoyed taking that role, doing other things, podcast, coach, all that stuff. So yeah, I appreciate it. It's certainly flattering to be called something other than just, hey, goalie guy Mike. So I appreciate it.
Well, not a problem. And I do appreciate you coming on. I do want to talk about the Golden Knights with you, obviously. But I do want to have, or while I have you, I want to get the chance to make you talk a little bit about yourself. So mention the hockey career off the top. It spanned two decades, included 4 years at St. Lawrence University, more than 500 minor league starts, Calder Cup finals on two occasions, and 35 games in the NHL, 6 seasons, 7 different clubs. If you did have to describe your playing career using one word, which one would you choose?
Journeyman is the obvious one because of all the teams I played for. You said 7 NHL teams, which is who I played for. I dressed for 9. So it doesn't show up on the hockey database, but I actually dressed for, I think, 24 professional hockey teams. Wow. And I was only traded twice. Claimed off waivers once. So all of those transactions were really going up and down between the minor league team and the American League and the big club, which is a compliment, I guess, in some ways. You know, I was wanted and had to battle for those chances. And that's the word I would like the most is battler. You know, I had to continually outplay my goalie partners, which ironically were always my best friends on the team, you know, but you're fighting for playing time. You're fighting for your career. And I knew I had to be top 10 in the American League if I wanted to keep getting jobs. If I was in the ECHL, I had to be one of the best if I wanted any chance of going to the American League and beyond. And that propelled me. You know, I never wanted to fall behind the technical curve. Even today with what I'm doing, whether it's coaching or analyzing, I need to be on top of things. You know, I want to know the latest in technique for goalies, for players. And I think that carried me. But just having that internal fire and competition and battling my way through things and, you know, not setting crazy goals. You know, I was very much an in the moment type of guy where I didn't try to forecast my future by saying I need to be in the NHL by this point. It was just purely, all right, I made it to this level. What can I do next? You know, how can I make the most of this and try to move on? And if I do, that's great. If I don't, well, it's been a great ride. And, you know, after as long as time I spent playing the game, it was a great ride.
Being in your position, it seems like there would be so many high stakes moments because you're getting this opportunity and you have to perform or you have to outplay, you know, this certain prospect that might have a little bit more juice behind them in terms of their organizational ranking. So it led to a lot of pivotal moments, I would assume. But of those pivotal moments, is there a most rewarding moment that you took advantage of? Was it playing in that first NHL game that sort of validated everything that you were doing and working for? Or is there something from your minor league days that stands out when you look back and reflect on your career now?
Yeah, there's a lot. You know, I mean, I think every game is really just as important. I think that's one of the misnomers that we face so much at hockey is, oh, this is a big game. Well, no, it's not. It's not any more important than any other game. They're all worth the same amount of points. You know, it's funny to hear people say that every single time. It's a big game. Well, if they're all big game, then they're all not a big game, right? But for me, like as far as the rewarding aspect, I can remember coming off the ice after my first game. It was in Long Island. I was playing with Tampa Bay. And I'd signed my first NHL contract 2 days before. I'd never even done a training camp, you know, like a preseason game proper. And I got tossed in midway through. And I come off the ice. I didn't allow a goal in, I think, 11 shots in a period and a half. And I remember looking at my jersey and I took it off. And that was kind of the moment it hit me where it was like, I did it. Like I played in the NHL, you know, I couldn't believe it. Like I was from St. Louis. Nobody from our city had ever played in the NHL when I was a kid, you know, and now we've had more than two dozen St. Louis kids that have played at this point. But goalies, I mean, I was the first goalie ever drafted out of St. Louis, you know, and I didn't even sign with Nashville who drafted me. So it was a pretty incredible road to do it. But my first win and shutout were the same night. It was a couple nights later in Tampa Bay. My parents were there. It wasn't an entry level contract, so Tampa didn't fly him in. They had to pick up the dime for that one. You know, my girlfriend, now wife, was there. And just coming off the ice and seeing them, my dad's there to give me a hug coming off, like, man, I can remember just happy crying that night. I couldn't believe it. And you think about all the people that have helped you and you know, the family aspect. My grandpa, who started hockey in St. Louis with a half dozen other people in the 50s, like, could he believe it if he were alive to see it? And those are huge. But I think really the most rewarding was probably going to game 7 of the Calder Cup Finals in 2018. That series against the Marlies when I was with the Texas Stars was just – it was an incredible run. I was playing the best hockey of my life. Our team was just so close, so much fun. We're throwing huge barbecues after each round and playing sand volleyball and just great memories, man. Those three moments, my last game that I ever played, I knew it was probably going to be that. So my parents came and again, hug from my dad coming off the ice, wave to my kids in the stands, win the game. Like, pretty amazing memories, man. I could go on and on, but I was really fortunate.
Oh, that's the beauty of your career. I mean, is all these different, these things that stand out. I think, I don't want to say that I have no experience and I can't speak for any current NHLers, but when it is the same thing over and over again, and you're not fighting and scrapping and battling, as you mentioned, maybe these things don't stand out as much as they do for you. But anyone who has the hockey resume that you have, I'm always curious about what your basement or game room looks like. I mean, does it tell the story of your professional career on the wall? Or have you had to, you know, step back and say, okay, these are probably better off tucked away in a closet somewhere?
Well, it's ironic that it is a closet. It's literally the guest room closet is my me room because I don't want my whole house to be a shrine to myself and my career. You know, I mean, I've got my college degree sitting above me in the office. I'm happy to show that off. My wife's right next to it. We've got both of those from St. Lawrence University, which we're very proud of, which we've also hardly used at all. My economics degree. But my closet has all my jerseys that I have. You know, you're not always given a jersey by teams until this newest CBA that just kicked in. Now they give the players a jersey. Well, in the past, that wasn't always the case. And, you know, I didn't finish my season in the NHL that often. And that's generally when you might get one. So a lot of my jerseys just went off into the unknown. And I've either had to trade or buy them back from collectors. My Vancouver Canucks jersey, it's missing. Have some leads where it may be, but people aren't responding. I'd really, really like to get that because it represents a really unique 2 days of my life. But I have most of my jerseys. I have all my masks. And that's the coolest thing for a goaltender for keepsakes. You know, you look around the closet and it's just I think it's 18 masks lining it, which is really cool. It tells a story. And I have a couple sets of gear that are hanging in the basement, just special ones, college first NHL set. But I made a pretty concerted effort not to keep too much stuff because it just, it takes up space. It's really cool. But it kind of comes down to like, how much of this can you really keep, you know? So tried to minimize it as much so the house isn't crazy me. I do have a family and kids.
Yeah. It does seem criminal though, that you weren't, until this latest CBA, that you weren't given a jersey if you were, you know, a one night only guy or your stay didn't last very long. It's beyond cheap, to be honest, but it's really strange.
I mean, you sweat and you bleed for that jersey, for that city, for that team, for that organization. And to not have been given a jersey at times, especially think about a guy who gets called up for two or three games and that's all you get. Think about that. Like, you work your entire life and you don't even get to keep your jersey. You know, that cost the team $250, maybe 200, what it is for retail cost on these. That was always hard to take, you know, and I'm glad that's changed. I know they fought for it, but there are some funny things about hockey like that. You know, like, I can't even access the NHLPA website because I didn't play 100 games as a goalie, you know? So like, there's a tiered system to being an alumni with the NHLPA. Crazy, isn't it? You know? So it's amazing how special of a club it is to even play one game in the league. But, you know, unless you were a full-time guy, 100 games, it can be a little different. But regardless of all that, man, it's still cool to be able to get those jerseys if you eventually do and take a look at them.
Your professional career began in Las Vegas in 2005 with the Las Vegas Wranglers. Is it just a coincidence that you find yourself back in Vegas now covering the Golden Knights, or is there a little more to it than that?
You know, when I went out and interviewed for the gig being an analyst, I thought, okay, I do have history here. So there's an awareness to the city, to what's been there previously with the Thunder, then with the Wranglers who I played with. But I think it was more so that I was recently out of the game and had built something of a brand for myself in media, even while playing, by doing in, you know, just things like live tweeting games from my McKenna and game count, or talking to people online, or writing, like I said, for NHL.com, or writing for Ingle magazine, just staying active in these forums that keep you out there. But I didn't know what I could do on TV. I didn't know that I could talk and analyze things in real time. That was new to me. But I do think the Vegas aspect certainly helped. You know, like, there are a lot of people in that city who have deep ties to hockey. You know, we drew 5,000 people a game to the ECHL, and they're all Vegas Golden Knights fans. That's a fourth of the people that are sitting in T-Mobile, you know? So it was really, really cool. I remember going for the interview and flying out the next day and thinking, man, this is where it all began. This is really cool. And then sure enough, being offered the opportunity to come back, like, pretty cool full circle moment.
Another reality for guys who hang around in the minor leagues for quite a long time is that you're plotting, or having to plot, your post-playing career. And you might go through different machinations or iterations of that. So I'm wondering, for you, how many plans were in place over the years? Was it always media for you? Was it always something that resembled coverage of the Golden Knights? What were you trying to work towards? And what role did writing for NHL.com, writing for InGoal magazine, starting a podcast, what role did all that play into where you were eventually headed?
Well, that's a great question, because I think if you asked me this 8-10 years ago, it would be very different than what it is today. You know, I always had an eye on media. You know, I would produce videos for the Peoria Rivermen and from Windows Movie Maker and things I'd do on a little Sony bloggy, you know, because we didn't have a PR department. So we'd go see the Boys and Girls, go to the Boys and Girls Club, go to the Humane Society. I'd film it. I'd do interviews, and I'd just put it all together. And it was more just a hobby for me, but I really enjoyed it. And I thought, maybe I can leverage this someday. If I'm doing this stuff now, maybe it'll pay off. And it did, obviously. But I always took interviews seriously. I took media seriously. You know, I didn't blow those off. I took every chance. And writing for InGoal magazine was a passion play. Like, I loved doing it. I loved talking goalie, but it kept my writing skills up. You know, I was good at it in college. I knew I could do it. And then NHL.com asked me, and I do it for them. And it was definitely in the back of my head that maybe I could do this, but I didn't see an avenue for it actually happening. I don't think it was until at least 2/3 of the way through my career where I started to get more NHL minutes. I started to be really a number three for people in organizations. That helped me. You know, it created my brand that was an NHL American League professional goaltender who has these experiences, which is unique. Not everybody does this while they're playing. And I think my last season where I kicked around five different teams, three NHL teams, I think that actually helped me. You know, my name was on the radar a little bit. But I think that as far as the podcast, like I wanted to start it the last year of my career. I was ready to go. I was recording my last year as early as November, and I held on to those interviews. But I didn't like the optics of putting it out while I was playing. You know, I just felt like it wouldn't be accepted a lot around the league, which is silly. It should. It's a hobby. It's something to keep your mind off of hockey, which is your day job, which will drive you insane if it's all you think about. So I still had that old school hockey mentality, I guess, where I just didn't like the optics. I wanted to make sure people thought I was focused, and I was. I always had other things going on. So, yes, I do think 8-10 years ago, I'm probably taking my econ degree and I'm somewhere in the business world or in money management. And but now as my career went on, it turned into, hey, you've got a chance, leverage it, see where it goes. And here I am.
You have lots of goalies on the podcast, 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. But besides that, when you are looking at, let's say you're dreaming of the perfect podcast guest, who would that person be?
Probably a hero of mine, you know, and I've had a lot of them on. You know, it's right. I think of the people that I've asked to do the podcast that have said yes, which is almost everybody. And if nobody's really turned it down. It's always just been a matter of finding the right time to do so. You know, when I mean, Greg Millen is the first goalie hero I had. I'm 4 years old watching the St. Louis Blues play. He catches with his right hand. I can't actually remember watching him play, but I know he was my first goalie hero. I've got a stick from him. I met him when I was probably 4 years old. My grandpa takes me down to the arena and meet him after a practice. I get a picture.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
With him. And I call Greg and he's like, absolutely, you know, and we've become friends with one another. And I look at those moments from my childhood to what they've become now. I mean, I was teammates with Marty Brodeur, you know, I was teammates with Roberto Luongo, right? Like I haven't had them on the podcast yet, but this is kind of what I'm leading to is that it's crazy to think about, but then the moment we do the podcast, it goes into goalie mode like that. And we just are two goalies talking, you know, and that's the best part is that we all speak the same language. And whether it's Glenn Hall, who I've done an interview with speaking about his experience from the 60s and 70s, or whether we're talking about a recently retired guy like a Peter Budaj, we still speak the same language. We understand the struggles. And that's just the coolest thing to me to be able to talk to other goalies like that and to branch out. You know, I've interviewed IndyCar drivers. I've interviewed a drummer. I've interviewed general managers, Ray Shiro, Ron Hextall. It's pretty amazing, man, that people will give me that time to do an interview.
Well, you mentioned being reluctant to put the podcast out while you were playing. And I guess there's a bit of a reluctance amongst the player population to, you know, appear on podcasts or to really, you know, bear all at a podcast or really speak too much about themselves. So if you could, you know, eliminate that consideration for someone in the game today, who would you really like to talk about the profession with that's active and on the ice right now?
Well, there's so many people that have a ton of insight to what's actually going. They're very analytical. They think of it in a very different mindset than a lot of people. And you don't necessarily see it come through in their interviews. You know, I think of like Jamie Benn to me is the most misunderstood guy in terms of median perception at times. Like, this is a guy who commands the room as a captain. Like, I was in that locker room for 2 months in Dallas, month and a half in Dallas, and there was no question in my mind that this is the captain, this is who it should be, this is a guy who controls the room in the right way and his teammates respect and love. But for some reason within media, there was this echo chamber that he was just distant and didn't care. And I'm like, this is the perfect example of how the public has no idea who should really captain a team. And I really would love to see him give his full opinion, his full personality at times, right? But he's reserved. That's not the way he leads. That's not the way he captains, right? He'd be fascinating to me to actually get in a laid back setting and really get him going, because he's a really fun guy too, you know? So that's one of them. I think Keith Yandel, I think everybody's on to King Keith Yandel at this point.
Yeah.
But man, like, talk about leaving an impression on you. There's a guy that is funnier than hell. It's not just he's fun. Like, this is a guy who's a damn good hockey player who really thinks the game well too. Like, there's a whole lot going on there that I think people would definitely appreciate. But you know, you get labeled something and that's it. He's the comedian. Well, no, he's also putting up 60 points a year as a defenseman in the National. So maybe those two guys, those would be really good guests.
Jamie Benn's interesting because I think that sort of misunderstanding of him maybe manifested itself a little bit when they were eliminated, I guess, in the Stanley Cup final. I guess it was game six against the Lightning. And he was showing his disappointment in a way that we necessarily haven't seen from Jamie Benn. And it kind of took people a little bit by surprise, or at least struck a lot of people. So maybe that was the most real the media has seen of Jamie Benn. And you might be the perfect person to strip it down a little bit more and get, you know, get to know who the real Jamie Benn is. I think that's a great idea. So you do a lot of things. Obviously, podcast is probably one of the things you're most comfortable with because you've been doing it for so long, doing it even before your playing career ended. But with the Vegas Golden Knights, you know, you're doing studio work. We've seen you do some stand-up, some on-cam interview stuff as well. You mentioned doing it way back when there was no PR department in the minor leagues. But so you've got some obvious experience here, but there are, you know, parts of the job are more challenging than others and more maybe you have to deal with a little bit differently. So what does come most natural to you in your now post-playing career? What are you most comfortable with, and what parts of the job continue to be a challenge for you?
Yeah, I think the easiest thing is just like this. I can be the interviewee all day long. You know, you ask me questions and I can run and talk way too much and go in different directions and not get focused. I'm good at that. I think the hardest thing for me is trying to flip the script and really just be concise and get my point across in a short manner and do it the right way on air. Because like when you're on TV and you start this analyst role, it's like you don't get a lot of help to start. And I don't mean that in a negative light to anybody in that they're not giving you support. They are, but it's not like you go to school, right? It's not like I could go to a 3-month deep dive on how to be a broadcaster for hockey. It doesn't happen. It's basically you go up there on stage and they're like, here you go. And so like learning the intricacies of it to make me feel comfortable. I know what I'm talking about. I have the knowledge of that. I have the insight. I have the experience to be able to convey those points. But what I didn't necessarily have was the comfortability of being someone who's really just projecting that air of confidence on TV, because I didn't know the actual working background to it, right? The camera looks, how to interact with my host, with people on air. That stuff was all new. So it was like learning the technical foundation of goaltending for broadcasting, right? And you're doing it on the fly, on air, on the national stage. So, you know, it was hard at first, but man, it was rewarding to get it. You know, I watch clips now and I'm like, hey, like, I should be confident. Like, I'm actually okay at this, right? And I know it's a work in progress. So that was really just getting me to feel comfortable so that my personality could come out without me feeling like I was forcing anything. You know, like podcasting to me isn't hard. I'm just asking questions with friends. If I have my homework laid out like you do, the questions kind of ask themselves, you know, but really just finding that comfortability to be on air, to project myself in a comfortable way that's confident and makes sense and is concise and short and in and out on answers on time is a challenge.
So in Vegas, you got Lawless, Millard, 90. Vegas has become this destination for players, but it looks like it's becoming a destination for broadcasters as well. Is the situation as desirable as it appears for members of the media working for the Vegas Golden Knights?
Well, I think if you ask anybody of that Manitoba breath in that you just mentioned, I think that they'll take Vegas over the cold of Manitoba any day. Now that's not slagging on Manitoba. They love their roots and they have very strong feelings and ties to that area. And I understand it for sure. But I do think that, net January in Vegas is pretty attractive to people. And it's not just that though, you know, you're not just talking about the weather. Like you want to be with an organization that one has a chance to win, two treats people the right way, three does everything to support you. You know, and it is unique for broadcasters in Vegas in that we're team employees. That's not always the case for people that are on TV. A lot of times those are hires of the local TV affiliate or whoever has the rights, you know. Mm-hmm. And so for us being team employees, it also affords us the chance to do other things within the team setting, around the city. It's desirable for sure. I mean, it's a reason why pretty heavy hitters have shown up, right? Like there's a lot of experience on our broadcast team. I'd argue as much as anywhere. And Dave Gosher, our play-by-play guys with the Bruins for a long time, comes to Vegas, and just listening to Dave Gosher and Shane Knighty during games is just an absolute treat. Those guys are so good at what they do, and to be able to riff on them and learn from them and lean on them, really, really cool.
It's, I mean, for someone who's dealing with, snow outside right now, it does, January in Vegas does sound pretty good. Okay, let's get into VGK. It didn't quite go to plan for both the Golden Knights and the NHL, I guess. But Vegas is coming off its first outdoor game appearance, one that took 10 hours to complete. But what does it say about the Golden Knights, the strength and rise and the footprint of this organization, that made it so NBC was just itching to showcase this team so quickly?
Well, a couple things. The biggest one to me is that look at the ratings in Vegas and in that market. And anytime they're on TV, they're huge. And there's a lot of people that look at Vegas and go, who are they going to draw on TV? Well, you know what? It's a funny phenomenon. We use it all the time in our own terminology of Vegas worldwide, the VGK worldwide, that it's true. Like people around the world have latched onto this team. It happens with expansion clubs at times, but I think because Vegas was something new and different, there were, especially kids, like kids will latch onto a new product anytime, right? They get a new LOL doll or they get a new, like, you know, Tonka truck or whatever. It's like the new one on the market. The kid loves it the most. Well, there's a new jersey on the market, right? It's a VGK jersey. Kid wants the jersey. Suddenly they're a VGK fan. VGK games do really well. They do well on ratings. There's fans everywhere. It's a growing brand. It's a hot brand. The team's been good and the team's built to win. They're entertaining games. Like you don't want to put a dud on the ice on a national scale if you can avoid it. Mm. And Colorado, Vegas, let's face it. Those are the two heavyweights in the West right now. I mean, there's no other, St. Louis, tread and water, right? Like Minnesota, maybe they got it, but Colorado and Vegas, man, Honda West, those are your teams. So putting them on the big scale in a place like Tahoe, incredible, right? It's a home run to do so. I know we had the delay, but man, sometimes you got to swing for the fences. And putting those two teams out there, I thought it was magic, man. Who cares if it took a little while to get it done? It did get done, and the visuals and just the opportunity for it was really cool to grow the game.
Just the beginning, obviously, for Vegas in those showcase moments, but hopefully just the beginning for the NHL in a scenario like that. I know it didn't go exactly to plan, but I think that was almost, that was the ideal. I think they captured the essence with that, and I think we should see more of that moving forward. But the Lake Tahoe showcase was part of a four-game set for Vegas versus the Colorado Avalanche, which concluded, Monday night. An impressive victory to split the series at 2. I mean, you mentioned those two teams being the heavyweights, and Vegas's most formidable challenger when talking about getting to the conference, or I guess it wouldn't be conference, it would be the league semifinals this year. So what is the mood after four? You don't want to call them measuring stick games, but what have we learned from these four games versus such a formidable opponent? And is Vegas feeling better, worse, or the same about the prospects moving forward now that we've seen this sample play out?
I think we saw that the two teams are getting to the point where they were sick of playing against each other and it started to boil over at the end of the game. You know, the last 10 minutes, there was some real nastiness, and you don't see that a lot in the NHL anymore. Like the game is not, very aggressive that often until you get teams that really feel engaged. And both of these teams do. You know, you've got Matt Calvert and Ryan Reeves jousting at center ice. Philip Grubauer's going after Will Carrier at the end of the game. I love it. Like, I love seeing a goalie get angry enough to get his gloves moving, you know? But that speaks to the rivalry. Like, as a player, that's what you want. You, as much as you look at those games and go, man, this is going to be a war tonight, you love it. You crave it. You want that engagement. You know, you don't want the Friday night where you're, oh, who are we playing? Oh, this team's second to last. Like, no, you want the best. And I think you saw that come out. Both teams played really good hockey during stretches of that four-game series. I think you're really seeing how much special teams are going to play a difference. So, I mean, the penalty kill for Colorado is just unbelievable. I mean, I think going into last night, 34 for 35 recently, Vegas could not get anything going except on the rush on the power play, you know, and that's where Vegas is going to need more is in zone ability on the power play. And you can't give momentum to Colorado. Even if Colorado doesn't score on their power play, it seems to really put the other team on their heels. When McKinnon gets the puck and he gets in zone, he starts wearing out your defensemen, throwing off your lines, it makes life harder. So 5-on-5, these two teams are going back and forth, entertaining as can be, but I felt like the special teams aspect of it, again, not strictly looking at goals for and against, but just the amount of momentum shifts and the time on ice really made this interesting. And Marc-Andre Fleury was just spectacular. And Philip Grubauer early in the series too. Two really good goaltenders, but ultimately, like, you got to give Fleury the edge with a couple of those shutout games. And last night, just incredibly fun to watch.
I want to get to Fleury in a moment, but I do want to touch on you know, how Vegas got to the point where they split with Colorado. Obviously, it was a very, very, very good record and still is after the four-game set with Colorado. But it wasn't exactly smooth sailing. I mean, we had COVID-19 issues. At times, they were forced to roll with five defenders as they sort of juggled the limitations on the salary cap. What was the key to getting off to such a tremendous start and overcoming the issues that did sort of plague them? Well, not necessarily plague them, but they did have to address, I guess, in the early going of the year.
Well, it was certainly unique. I mean, 13 forwards and 5D, that's not ideal. It puts a big load on your defense. It's taxing. It's not easy for, you know, Alex Pietrangelo to come in. He's playing massive minutes right away in a new system. But you've also got Shea Theodore to foil you, who's one of the top D in the league at this point, I find. But I think for the Golden Knights, it really was just a continuation of their play in the bubble. I know they didn't get what they wanted to, eventually losing out to Dallas and playing some hard games against Vancouver. But they were playing so well there that they kind of stuck with it and kept it going. And it's the depth of the team. You know, they're getting scoring throughout the lineup, first three lines, defense. You look at some defensive units in the NHL and they're a black hole after the first defenseman or two, you know, and Vegas is now getting it from three or four defensemen, five defensemen are producing. And a lot of that has been Pete DeBoer's system, activating the defense, making sure that the Golden Knights get the puck to the forwards as quick as they can, get through the neutral zone in a hurry, attack the net. That's all made a difference. They're playing really fast. They have since the start. And any sloppiness that was there from not having the preseason games was overcome by the skill level. Like, this is just a really deep team. And it's like Colorado. It's like Boston. It's like Philly. It's any of those teams you wanted to name. Top to bottom on the roster, there's not many holes. And the center ice position people had questioned about with Smith Vegas has been filled pretty well by, you know, Cody Glass has done well. And so they're rolling. But I think, you know, skill level, system, depth, it all plays into it.
Certainly not a hole at the backup goaltender position. Obviously, there was a ton of debate around the goaltending position with Robin Lehner re-signing and about $12 million devoted to the position. And that's, you know, as much of a reason as anything that they had to roll with five defensemen early in the year because so much money was tied up at that position. But it has proven to be a good thing that he wasn't shipped out just because of Leonard's emergence, because Lehner has been out of the lineup and Fleury has been playing at a Vezina caliber level. Is this just more proof that he remains sort of an indispensable element for this team, a piece to the puzzle, even with salary cap issues? And does his performance of late change anything about the plans moving forward?
I don't know what's going to happen moving forward, to be honest with you. I can't predict that at all. It is a lot of money tied up, but man, I don't know how you can move on from a guy who's the backbone of your team at this and is proving it yet again and playing at this level is what it comes down to. He has been incredible to watch. And he's made adjustments. You know, he's 36 years old, but he's always had the willingness to listen to people, to make adjustments when necessary to improve his game. We've seen that. He's a little closer at home. He's playing between his posts more often. He's not chasing the game as much. That leads to better rebound control. It leads to less scrambling, which, of course, you know, with a highlight reel, saves are always what we see, where he is having to scramble, but that doesn't show all the work he's done before that to be in position that he's done a better job with this year. But, you know, $12 million, yeah, you can look at it as a number, but there's this giant boogeyman out there like, oh, you can't spend more than $10 million on goalies. Why? You can't win a Stanley Cup without goaltending. Goaltending is the most important position. Goaltending is your most important penalty killer. Goaltending. And then nobody wants to pay for goaltending. You know, that's always been mind-blowing to me. So I don't know going forward if this is the right setup or not, but I look even at Montreal in the same way, how Jake Allen's been great for Carey Price. I think it's real, and I think that they can manage it. But Fleury has been, he's been the backbone and the heartbeat of this team since its inception, and it's continued this year. And I can't imagine that stopping anytime soon.
And you mentioned the importance of goaltending. I mean, that might be the reason why losing Philip Grubauer, the Colorado Avalanche last year in the playoffs, that might be the only reason why they didn't go as far as they perhaps should have.
And I'll toss this too. Pavel Francouz, I like a lot. I think he's a really good goaltender, but he was hurt as well. You know, so you just, it's tough when you lose those two guys in a big hurry.
I like how you mentioned Fleury making changes to his game, because as a quick aside here, I think Fleury is one of the more entertaining, probably the most entertaining netminder to watch. And I guess maybe that is, we're just seeing those highlights sometimes, but even just watching him play full 60 minutes, very entertaining goalie. But for someone who teaches the position or advises on the position, is entertainment value generally a detriment to a netminder's game? And would Fleury be considered an exception to that?
In some ways, I mean, you don't want to have too many exciting saves because it means you're out of position. But in Marc-Andre Fleury's case, especially this season, those desperation, diving, lunging, explosive saves have been born of necessity, right? It's when you see somebody as a goaltender do something that you don't have to. Like, just because you can do the splits doesn't mean you should do them. It means you can't recover. It means you're lunging. It means you're not pulling your back leg. It means you're exposing the top of the net. And quite frankly, I think that's why you've seen Jonathan Quick's numbers go like this, because he hasn't adapted the same way like a Marc-Andre Fleury has, that he's staying more upright, torso up, reading shots, not relying on being down on your knees as much, staying on your edges and being as patient as you can. So it's interesting with Fleury, because we do see those saves. But I think that when you make a 40 saves, when you have 34 saves in a game and it's a shutout, you're going to have those, right? Mm-hmm. And I think he made probably two saves last night that shouldn't have been saved, and he made it. And that's the difference. So from a technical standpoint, last season, there were things I saw with him that I didn't like. I thought that he was chasing. I thought he was making the game hard on himself, setting his feet a foot outside the crease. Now he's reined it back a little bit. He's playing with a little flow, a little more patience. He's allowing himself to react to pucks, which is his strength. He's one of the greatest reactionary goaltenders to ever play the game. Give yourself that chance. A little deeper, use your hands, but let pucks hit your chest. That's what we're seeing with Marc-Andre.
Alex Pietrangelo was the biggest free agent acquisition, and a guy that Kelly McCrimmon moved mountains, maybe not Lake Tahoe mountains, but mountains nonetheless to acquire on the open market. How would you grade his transition so far to Vegas, and how much stronger is the Golden Knights defense under this reorganization?
I think the defense is stronger. I think that's the most important thing. If you're looking at it, from 10,000 feet, it's a net win right now. I don't think we've seen the best of Alex Pietrangelo. He's been fine. He's been a good NHL defenseman. But what you saw with the St. Louis Blues was he was the guy. He was the guy with the puck on his stick. He was over the boards in every instance, and he's still doing that for the Golden Knights, but he's not driving offensive chances like he did with St. Louis. Like, he was a one-man breakout with St. Louis. Things are different with Vegas. Now it's about getting the puck to the forwards quicker, joining the rush, being the late man. He's got a good feel for that. But I think that for him, especially not having the exhibition games to get used to the new system, was a challenge. You know, he'd never played in any other organization, right? He's had different coaches, but never another organization. So I think he's still finding his way. I think him going into COVID protocol didn't help in terms of on ice. You know, it gives you a chance to visually see things. But his offensive production isn't quite I think, where anybody expects it just yet. But I would encourage patience there for sure, because players that are that good generally figure it out. And he's got support around him with Vegas to make that happen.
What I find interesting about Vegas is that its biggest stars are perhaps known for defensive abilities first. Marc-Andre Fleury, Robin Lehner, Mark Stone, obviously a great forward, but known as maybe the best defensive forward in hockey. Petrangelo, Theodore might be their best two players. These are real game changers on the team, and they're all, you know, under that sort of category of their strength. There's their ability to deny the opposition. Obviously, there is offensive upside with each. But I think with, you know, all that talent in that vein, that it might leave something to be desired from an offensive standpoint. And I think we saw that in the playoffs where they had a very difficult time scoring. Now they got Chandler Stephenson as their number one center, and he was a guy, was a tremendous add, maybe one of the best deadline acquisitions last year, but a number one center? I'm not sure. So do the Golden Knights, in your opinion, have enough firepower to score goals? I think they're a middling team right now, and that's okay. It's very early on in the season. But when it comes down to it, when it gets a little bit more difficult to score, are the Golden Knights set up to score enough to compete, I guess, with the Colorado Avalanche?
Well, I think it just comes down to execution, and it comes down to your system to make that happen. Do they have the firepower? Sure. I mean, Max Pacioretty's been trending towards career totals on goals, and I know that's just one player. But you look at what him and Stone do together is pretty amazing. Now, they threw the lines in a blender last night. Vegas did. They're all over. I suspect that that's Pete DeBoer throwing a different look at the Colorado Avalanche and shaking his players up a little bit to see what works. You never know unless you try it. But I do think, like, what Vegas ran into last year was that they were just trying to funnel pucks to the net. And the refrain was, okay, yep, we need bodies at the net and traffic, bodies at the net and traffic. And, you know, 5 years ago, that was the game, was nothing but deflected shots, screen shots. And they weren't getting a lot through the middle. They weren't making seam passes. They weren't changing angles, doing high tip plays, creating chaos that way rather than just physical bodies. And I think I've seen more of that this year. They've tried different looks in zone, on the power play, hanging onto the puck a little bit longer rather than just shot volume. And I do think there's a very fine line there. Like, there is a correlation to the number of shots you get on net and winning, but you don't want to just put floaters there and hope. There has to be a purpose to it. So there's a fine line, but I think this season, especially to me, they've done a better job of that. And really, like, they haven't fallen out of games. Like, when things get tough, they've always had a response. And to me, that's the mark of a really good team. Yeah, Colorado can score, but I think these two teams are so closely matched. It's fun hockey to watch. I'll tell you that. And I don't know really which team by the end of the year is going to be the best. It may just come down to who's got healthy bodies.
One of the crazier things for me when looking at the team that went to the Stanley Cup final in its first year, it's almost non-existent now, with the exception of one line. And I know the lines went into a blender last night, but William Karlsson, Jonathan Marchessault, and Riley Smith, they've sort of remained as this one, you know, center block or centerpiece that has not changed and has achieved longevity. So how have they achieved that longevity? What separates them? What makes them different? And what do they mean to this franchise big picture from more of a legacy standpoint? And in addition to what they mean for the success this year and moving forward?
The original misfits. It's interesting with that line. And again, they were split up last night. Last year, Karlsson went up and played between Pacioretty and Stone for a decent amount as well. But to me, they're kind of like the Rock. They're old faithful. Marchessault, Smith, Karlsson. Pete DeBoer knows what he's getting with them. And there's been nights this year where they've been the best line. Generally on a line, you look for one player to really drive the boat. And with them, I don't think that's the case. You know, Will Karlsson's so heady. He's a great 200-foot player. And Riley Smith's the same way. He complements him very well. That first year for Karlsson where he couldn't miss the net on anything and he scored at like a 25% clip, probably not going to see that again. But his strength is really, you know, what he does in the defensive zone on kills as well as offensively. And Jonathan Marchessault always says that playing with them just makes the game easy. He's like, I just have to go out there and they give me the puck, you know. And it's they're at the point where they know where each other's going enough that they can make semi, you know, questionable plays happen because they have that knowledge of where the other person is, right? It's, they can be a little optimistic at times, One, because they trust where they're going to be, but two, they also trust the defensive game of one another, that even if they go for something and doesn't pan out, they'll be able to get back and cover for it. So, you know, Carlson's got good speed. Smith is just an incredibly intelligent player. And I mean, Marchessault just wants to shoot. It's all he wants to do. Give him the puck, let him shoot. So they're a nice trio. I like them together.
Knowing what we know now about this team, is there an obvious improvement that could be made before the deadline to better equip this team for the postseason and for making the run towards the Stanley Cup, which is every expectation in Vegas right now?
Well, if this was last year, I think it was pretty easy. They needed a right shot defenseman. They needed it all season last year. Shea Theodore was getting worked hard. They got Alec Martinez, who is a left shot. But he was a great player with Theodore. But what happened last year is Zach Whitecloud came into the mix. He elevated himself to an NHL defenseman. So it came from within. This year they go out, they get Alex Pietrangelo, and now Dylan Coghlan has also come into the lineup. Three right-handed defensemen. I think they're good on the back end. Nick Hague's emerged. They've got depth coming from within, which is great. Center ice is still the question, right? You're still looking for centermen that can drip, that can really drive that third line. They've tried different people. Nick Waugh's been there. Keegan Kolesar's been there. Cody Glass has been there. I think Glass is probably who you're looking at as being the person to fill that role and grow further. I mean, this is a first-round pick, early first-rounder, great skill level that they believe in. You know, you're looking for him to eventually be first, second line, right? So I'm not sure at this point that the depth is where they would like it to be for center, but I think you have people growing into that role. So by the end of the season, will they be there? That's the hope. Do they have to do something at the deadline? Who knows? Because I think, again, the hope is to really expect these young players like Glass, even Stevenson, to continue to grow and elevate their game.
Three quick ones before I let you go. The best netminder in the NHL today is who?
I think it's Andrei Vasilevskiy. I just... From a technical standpoint, from a battling standpoint, from an athleticism standpoint, from a statistical standpoint, his gold save above average is top of the list. I mean, it's not just that Tampa's that good. I think Vasilevsky's the benchmark for everybody.
And we're spending money on. The best addition to the Golden Knights, new sartorial selection, we'll call it. They got the gold jerseys, they got the gold helmets, and they got the reverse retro fits. Which of the three is your favorite?
Reverse retro, man. I'm an old Las Vegas Wrangler. I wore the red jersey in Vegas, and I think those jerseys are sharp. They're unique. The colors work, and they're flying off the shelves. So, yeah, I'm reverse retro. Team reverse retro all the way.
There you go. Okay, and if the border ever allows me to cross into the United States again, I need some food recommendations for the Strip. What's your favorite restaurant in Vegas right now?
It's actually off the Strip. Okay, it's called Black Sheep, and Chef Jamie Tran is going to be on Top Chef in America this coming season. It's in Portland. I think they shot it in Portland, Oregon over the summer, I guess. She is unbelievably talented, and that kitchen does no wrong. Tiny little place. There's so many good places on the Strip. A lot of, you know, celebrity chefs that you can kind of throw the dart at the board and have a good meal. It's tough to miss in Vegas. But if you're willing to venture out a little bit on the west side of town, I would definitely recommend Black Sheep. I've never had a bad meal there. Everything's always been incredible.
There you go. A food recommendation and a show recommendation with Top Chef coming soon. Mike, I really appreciate it. I appreciate you going through those technical difficulties with us and getting through it. It was a fun conversation. I appreciate the insight. And keep up the great work you're doing with Vegas and beyond.
Thanks, Justin, man. Anytime. I appreciate it. Fun talking hockey.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.